Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and we are in-depth on the future of President Trump's travel ban. As you may know by now, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in October on whether the president's travel ban will stand. Trump issued an executive order in March which suspended the U.S. refugee program for 4 months and restricted travel from 6 Muslim countries. The ban has been on hold because 2 federal appellate courts blocked it. The countries affected by the ban include Libya, Syria, and other predominantly Muslim nations. Monday, the court permitted part of the travel ban to be implemented and blocked another part of it. Today, a discussion about what the court said and what its decision to hear the case in the fall means. And we welcome your calls and your questions today, because a lot of this is kind of confusing. What puzzles you or concerns you about the travel ban? Are you supportive of the president's measure to restrict travel from certain countries and to suspend the refugee program? What else do you want to know about it? So I'd like to hear from people on all ends of the political spectrum here, whether you support the president in general or not. How do you feel specifically about this policy? And what concerns you? What kinds of questions do you have about this travel ban? And what some of the questions that the court may ask as arguments are held in October? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, William Stock, is an immigration attorney. He's president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. And he's with us today from Philly. And Bill, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, Carrie. It's great to be back.
Kimberly Atkins is with us. She's a Washington correspondent for the Boston Herald and a columnist. She focuses on the Supreme Court and Congress. And she's with us from D.C. And Kimberly, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to talk to you.
So Kim, before the court ruled on Monday, we were in a situation where refugees and travelers from the countries that the president had targeted were permitted to come to the U.S. as long as they followed normal visa rules. Is that right?
That is correct. That is correct. This revised travel ban that the president issued never took effect because, as you mentioned, 2 appellate courts blocked it before it could.
And Bill, to be clear here, those visa procedures are pretty extensive. I don't want to leave our audience with the impression that you could open the borders. It was very simple to come in. They were all still in effect, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we are already seeing during the time that this ban, was under litigation, that the number of visas for people from these 6 countries has dropped precipitously when compared to the numbers issued last year. But, you know, you have to remember that for the majority of the people in the world, 85% would be denied any kind of temporary visa to come visit the U.S. even. So anyone coming here is not just has to fall within one of the few categories of people who are allowed in under the immigration laws, but then they're also extensively vetted through databases and facial recognition technology, fingerprints. Those are all used by our enforcement agencies to protect us.
I have to say, I wasn't aware that the number was that high, 85% of people who are denied. And what are usually the reasons for that?
Well, remember, that's 85% when we're talking about the universe of people from countries like the 6 banned countries, which are generally less developed economically than the United States. Obviously, the visa denial rates are much lower when we're talking about countries that have sort of comparable economic situations to the U.S. The primary reason why people are denied is that they cannot convince a U.S. consular officer that they have enough ties back to their home country that they'll leave at the end of their temporary visa. So, that's meant to prevent the kinds of undocumented migration of people who come on a temporary visa and then determined to stay long term.
Kimberly, I was under the impression that when the president announced this, he said, we need some time to think about, to get our act together, to figure out what's going on. And that's why the refugee policy was apparently temporary and why the travel ban was supposed to be temporary. Do you have any indication that the White House and administration staffers are doing the kind of work that would help them figure out whatever they needed to figure out in the interim.
Well, there's no clear indication that that has been taken place. And so that is a part of, as you said, this revised travel ban. And so it was unclear to some extent whether the injunctions that stopped implementation of this travel ban also prevented this specific directive to the Department of Homeland Security from conducting this review and figuring out exactly what policy to put in place. It seemed that one of them may have blocked that, but the other didn't. But of course, it still didn't stop the White House from a policy perspective from developing some sort of plan in general to deal with immigration, to toughen immigration rules and immigration laws. And so to that extent, there is no indication that the White House did that. And ultimately, once this this case goes before the court, it could cut against their argument that there is an emergency and this ban needed to be in place quickly in order to deal with this issue.
And Bill, Kimberly is saying that because if there was urgency and an emergency, they've had time to do something about that. Now we'll be all the way into October, months and months afterwards. What do you think the prospect of that will be?
I think it is very clear that the Supreme Court's willingness to put this off to the October term means that, at least the six justices who voted to modify but leave in place much of the injunction, would agree with what was just said, that, there really wasn't any urgency here. This was, something that in a normal administration might have been held with an internal policy review and no changes made until all the stakeholders within the government had their say on it. And the president acknowledged as much back on June 14th when he delayed the effective date of the order. It will now go in effect 72 hours after the injunction is listed. So, the order's not even effective until June 29th. Wow.
Call here from Doug in Minneapolis. Doug, what are you curious about? Hi, Doug.
Good morning.
Are you there? Hi, go ahead. What are you curious about?
Yeah, I guess you're talking about exactly what my question was. Initially, if I remember correctly, it was a 90-day ban so they could get their ducks in a row or vet their vetting process. And it's been past that time. And as far as I know, they haven't done anything to fix that.
It
shows their hand.
Yeah, Bill, from following up here on what Doug is saying, is it possible that the White House is doing things behind the scenes to adjust the policy and they just haven't announced what they're doing?
The White House is using the excuse that it believed the travel ban litigation stopped it from doing the kinds of vetting that it was going to do. There are some provisions of that executive order which could be very disruptive to international relations. Every country is supposed to be reviewed, and the Department of State is supposed to come up with a list of countries that don't provide us with enough information about their citizens to adequately vet visa applications. Well, review hasn't happened, and a lot of the career folks in the State Department are very concerned because visa processing is very much a reciprocal kind of arrangement. If you tell Brazil that they're not sharing enough information, they will say, well, sure, we'll issue visas to Americans only when you share all kinds of private information with us.
Got it. Call here from Abdi in Minneapolis. Hi, good morning.
Good morning. I have a big concern.
Abdi, I'm afraid your phone is cutting out. Do you want to try it again? You may have to call us back. Phone call here from Derek in Plymouth. Hi, Derek. What are you interested in?
Yeah, I come at it a little bit different perspective. I start from the premise, right, we have three branches of government, and the executive branch has to enforce the laws, and if the president feels like people shouldn't come into the country, I mean, non-American citizens don't have a right to be in this country at all, and so someone's got to make that decision, and it can't necessarily be in the courts all day long. So I just think it's kind of silly that this was even a lawsuit to begin with. But I guess my next question, more generally, were you able to get someone to defend the Trump's administration's position on the travel ban. I mean, I don't know if your two guests, are they for it or against it? I don't know if you've got a full panel here.
I think, Kimberly, I don't think you take a position on whether you're for or against it, right?
Bill? I don't. My job is to report what happens.
Right. And Bill, do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, what I'll do is, I think that your caller raises a really important point, which is, before the first travel ban, I taught immigration law for many years. I would have pointed to 140 years of precedent where the Supreme Court has said that, the judicial branch does not interfere with immigration. That's one of our sort of foundational constitutional principles. We call it the plenary power doctrine, that the legislature and the executive have plenary power over immigration. But travel ban number one was so clearly implemented with a targeting of Muslims that it raised a different fundamental constitutional principle, and that is that the federal government cannot favor one religion over another or disparage one religion over another. And it was the collision of those two big principles which really produced the litigation over the first version of the travel ban. Now, when the second travel ban came out, I thought it was actually prepared with very careful attention to the kinds of people who would be able to raise that sort of First Amendment claim. And it really took away a lot of the strength of the First Amendment claim. You know, I think the courts that enjoined this were willing to look beyond the text of the second order and were willing to sort of impute to the second order the same kind of religious animus that they said was evident in the first version of the ban. But, you know, I think the Supreme Court has weighed in. I think they have said both that the second version of the ban, is not, they're going to look at it not sort of with the same impugning of that religious motivation that some of the lower courts did, but they're also signaling that there are American interests in place here. And, you know, the important thing to remember is that while the courts generally stay out of immigration, it is Congress that sets the rules as to who's allowed to come into the United States. The president is not allowed to unilaterally say that, well, there's some kind of visa or some kind of person that I don't like, and so I'm just going to not issue the visas that Congress said should be issued in this situation. So I think that's when there's a tension between those two branches of government, that's where the judiciary often has to step in.
Yeah, Bill, just want to follow up on what you said about kind of the posture of the court in taking a look at this second version of the travel ban. The Supreme Court language on lifting part of the ban said, "We grant the government's applications to stay the injunctions to the extent the injunctions prevent enforcement with respect to foreign nationals who lack any bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the U.S." Why are they making the distinction between people coming into the United States or wanting to come in who have some kind of connection here and people who don't?
Yeah, so you have to understand that the constitutional law of immigration, focuses on the constitutional rights of Americans. And so the court is very carefully saying, you know, there are two Supreme Court cases, one very recent, Kerry versus Dinn, it's called, from 2015, another from the 1970s called Kleindienst versus Mandel. And in those cases, they were both brought by American citizens saying that their First Amendment rights were being limited by the fact that the government was not providing information or an opportunity for visa applicants to come to the United States. And what both of those cases said was that those American citizens have to be satisfied as long as the government produces a facially legitimate and bona fide reason. That's a very low standard. It has to, on its face, make sense, and it has to not be in bad faith. By leaving this injunction in place, we're getting a little bit of a signal that, at least as to Executive Order 1 and possibly to Executive Order 2, if the government is thinking of expanding its application, that the Supreme Court is not thinking there is a real safety reason at the core of this or that it was issued in good faith.
Hey, Kimberly, I wondered what the dissents from Justice Alito, Thomas, and the new Justice Neil Gorsuch the way that was phrased tells you about what may happen when the full case is considered before the court in October.
Yeah, so I start with the preface is saying whenever you're dealing with an order involving a preliminary injunction, it's always a little it's not completely wise to make broad generalizations how the court might rule on the merits. I mean, one of the considerations of leaving an injunction in place is whether the parties have a likelihood to succeed on the merits, the one seeking the injunction.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that part of it was rolled back is automatically an indication by the court that they haven't necessarily met that very high threshold. It doesn't mean they're going to lose when they get to the court, but that high threshold of likelihood to succeed isn't in place. And that's one of the many factors. But rolling back, yeah, looking at this dissent, three justices said they would have lifted the injunction completely while the court takes up this order. In the dissent written by Clarence Thomas that said actually it would have made more sense to leave the whole thing in place, even though they would have voted to lift it,
right,
than it would to have this sort of half and half. It applies to some people and not others, because the legal basis for that seemed to be unclear to these justices, as well as the concern that it would be administratively difficult for immigration officials to have to kind of go through and figure out, okay, does this person qualify under this injunction to come through? Are their context to the United States strong enough, or do they not? And under the penalty of contempt of court if they get it wrong. And so they really disagreed with this sort of compromise solution that the majority came to.
Kimberly Atkins is one of our guests. If you've just tuned in, she's chief Washington reporter, columnist for the Boston Herald, focuses on Congress and the Supreme Court. And Bill Stock is with us. He's an immigration attorney out of Philadelphia. He's past president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Getting some insight from both of them on the policy and the legality and the constitutional issues and the politics around what the Supreme Court did yesterday, leaving part of President Trump's travel ban in place and holding on another part of it, and then saying that they will hear the full case in October. I'm asking you about what puzzles you, concerns you about the travel ban, whether you're supportive of the president's measure to restrict travel from certain countries and suspend the refugee program. Also interested, I know we have a section of the community here that is involved in refugee issues and immigration issues. If you work in that part of the community, it would be interesting, I think, for us to hear about how this has changed the way you're doing your work, how it's changed your communication and your work to bring people in from overseas. I think you'd shed some light on this as well. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter at NPR, at Carrie NPR, to Marie in Rochester. Hi, Marie. Appreciate you waiting.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to support what President Trump is trying to do, and I think it goes back to even the time when he was campaigning, when he stated his stance on this issue is to have a more thorough vetting process, especially when it comes to allowing people from, you know, terrorism hotbeds, where there's actually training camps set up in some of these countries. And I think that's what the president is trying to do, is keep the American people safe. He is definitely not a prejudiced person. And I think that he is just trying to do his job to the best of his ability and withhold his promises or uphold his promises from the election. So,
Marie,
I do support him at this time. He's been cast with the hardest job in the world, and I do support him. We have to support him. He's trying to do a job no one else has been able to do.
I appreciate the call. And, Kimberly, I think it's valuable that Marie reminds us. President Trump talked about this a lot on the campaign. I mean, this was debated during the campaign. He is following through on something he committed to doing.
And that's absolutely right. And that plays a big role in this case. I mean, you are right that the president has very broad power when it comes to immigration policy. That is very true. And it's within the parameters, obviously, as Bill noted, of constitutional and statutory law. But a big factor in this case in particular is that the president didn't just talk about being tough when it comes to protecting the country and counterterrorism efforts and vetting of immigrants. on the campaign trail and on his website until very recently, he called for a ban, a temporary ban of all Muslims entering the country. And that's at the crux of this case, is because the challengers allege that this the immigration orders as implemented were actually efforts to carry out in some way that proposed Muslim ban. And while the president does have very broad powers when it comes to immigration, the Constitution and federal law prevents a policy that's specifically targeting one religion. And so that would be impermissible. So the courts have been looking at the president's statements on the campaign trail, his tweets before and since implementing these orders, and the words that are literally coming from him as a core piece of evidence in this case. And in the lower courts, they found that that showed a animus toward Muslims, and that was the reason that they stopped the order from going into place.
And Bill, this is something I wanted to ask you about as well, what Kimberly just brought up. I mean, when you read the order from the Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia, and I know you know the phrase that I'm going to pull out, they say in this order that the travel ban, quote, drips with religious intolerance, animus, and discrimination. Is that First Amendment issue going to be a key part of the argument in October?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the states are certainly going to be trying to make sure that they can pull in as much of that evidence that we were talking about, because, as I said, the only way this case is even a little bit of a question is because of the depth of the number of times that, as a candidate, the president talked about a Muslim ban, and his advisors talked about a way of getting around calling it a Muslim ban, and those kinds of things. So the Supreme Court has certainly in the past looked at situations where state governments or local governments have tried to use religiously neutral language when a whole history of how that local law came into place was religiously motivated. You know, look, I'd also respond to the caller that,
Marie?
I didn't agree
yeah.
with, I heartily disagree that our job is to support the president as citizens of this country. Our job is to call out mistakes that a president made. When President Obama wasn't following the law and was funding Obamacare with unappropriated funds, that was just as inappropriate as President Trump going beyond the powers granted by Congress in some of these ways. So, you know, I think that we do have as citizens a responsibility to kind of evaluate what's going on here and make sure that we are a nation of laws, not of people who have power.
Phil says on Twitter, so if it's about terror, why not imposed on Saudi Arabia, the source of many 9/11 attackers? And Wynn says the travel ban was sold as temporary and needed so the administration had time to reexamine the policy for 90 or 120 days. And Wynn, if you missed the beginning of the conversation, we talked about that. But I think we have a caller question on this to John in Spring Valley. John, is that something you're curious about as well?
Yes, I believe I've heard that the point will be moot or just about moot by the time the Supreme Court gets around even to hearing arguments. So isn't that going to come into play?
Bill, will you weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think you're quite correct that mootness is going to come into play. The president has clearly tried to insulate his order from the mootness challenge with his memorandum on June 14th that delayed the effective date. So the 90 days doesn't begin to run until Thursday of this week, June 29th. But absolutely, by the time we get to October, mootness is going to be an issue before the court, and it may be the way that the court decides to avoid having to issue a substantive decision on the case.
And yet, Kimberly, I mean, this does kind of go back to what have they been doing in the interim, and I mean, what would they conceivably say about that? We needed it. We ended up doing nothing during it. You know, what's the answer to that?
Yeah, that's one of the tougher arguments for the government to make on that point of urgency, and that goes to the case is about the balancing interests, right? The hardship placed on people trying to get into the country versus the interest of the government in national security and executing policies to keep the country safe. So it cuts against that second point that there is this exigent need to stop people from coming into the country. And of course, one thing that the administration could do is in this period between Thursday, now when portions of when this travel ban goes into effect toward some entrance into the United States, sit down with the Department of Homeland Security and the Justice Department and other relevant agencies, come up with a review, come up with a plan, and execute it before oral arguments can be put into place. That would be one of the smartest things for it to do, because it would say, look, see, this is what we needed to do.
Right.
We've done it now, and it would weigh in their favor. So we'll see if that actually happens.
And yet, Bill, I mean, as we said at the beginning, there are very, very strict procedures in place right now if you're trying to get a visa. I mean, can you imagine what else could be put into place that really shows that we were in some kind of emergency situation here?
Exactly. And I think that the other side of this is the cost and benefit to American citizens. I think everyone listening to this program needs to think about the number of jobs in Minnesota at the Mall of America, at the Mayo Clinic, at other hospitals and educational institutions around the state are dependent on the ability of people from other countries to get in. You know, after 9/11, Jeb Bush had to call his brother up and ask him to, you know, stop being so strict in the visa categories because Disneyland was losing money because there are so few foreign tourists. You know, I think we have to remember that, you know, with this call to just ban people or keep them out, we are going to keep out many more good people by doing that than we will, you know, exposing ourselves to any kind of risk. You know, the risks just aren't there from these countries, right? I mean, the terrorism threats we faced have been from American citizens, from people raised here. So that's, I think, you know, another thing that it weighs on the court as they consider this ban.
It's what we call homegrown terrorism, right? Radicalization from within these countries in Europe and the U.S.
Absolutely.
Call here from Corrine in Minneapolis. Hi, Corrine. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, yeah, thanks. I just wanted to kind of comment and also hear your guys' thoughts on. So I work at a local refugee resettlement agency here in the Twin Cities.
Yeah.
And meeting with people kind of from all over Minnesota, one of the biggest misconceptions that I honestly probably wouldn't know super well if I wasn't working in it is that what's happening in Europe is exactly the opposite of what's happening here. And talking to refugees when they come and the at least 18-month process that they go through and the average wait time in a refugee camp being like 17 years. And almost every refugee I've talked to is like waited years and years and years to be able to come here and gone through so many different security measures. But I think it's confusing watching the news because, of course, you'd be afraid and you would be confused watching like what's happening in Europe because that's a totally different situation in regards to vetting. And so just talking about the vetting system, like you had just said, I think, Bill, is already so incredible in the U.S. for bringing refugees specifically here.
This is a really good point, Corrine. Yeah. Kimberly, let me bring you in on that. I mean, Corrine's saying we watch the news coverage out of Europe. We see you know, waves of refugees coming out of places like Iraq and Syria and landing on the doorstep of Europe. We have a different situation here than the Europeans do.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there are few things that are more difficult to do than to make your way into the United States as a refugee from Syria or nearby countries affected by the ISIS catastrophe that is taking place there. It's a very difficult process. There is a lot of vetting in place, and it takes an extremely long time. And that's one reason, aside from the limits that were placed put in place by the United States, that the United States has a fraction, I mean, a literal drop in the bucket of the total number of refugees who have come here as compared to the hundreds of thousands or millions that have gone into European countries. And there's also another factor. Refugees are people who need temporary placement, but who ultimately want to go back to their homes once the political situation that is causing them peril is over. And it's a lot more difficult for them to do and to keep that tie if they go all the way around the world. So the United States is usually not even the first desired place for refugees to go. So I think even if there were not this very strict vetting that the United States have, we would not see the numbers of refugees that you see in these European countries. It's a very, very different situation.
A call here from Jeff in St. Louis Park. Hi, Jeff. What's your
How
question
you
or what are you thinking about? I'm doing well. Thanks.
So there's a few different things. I think the first thing is that going back to this is more of a travel ban for countries that we couldn't vet people out. And this is actually originally brought up by President Obama and his staff. So I don't know why it's such a big deal right now when Trump does it. Granted, I know he did say some things that were kind of effusive during the campaign. But all things aside is that it's really apples to apples here. And we're having the exact same conversation, which if Obama imposed this, wouldn't it be the same?
Okay, so hold on that question for a minute and stay with me, because, Bill, my understanding of what President Obama did was extra vetting, not blocking. Tell me what about... You know,
yeah,
what actually happened
correct.
With Jeff?
And I think it's a talking point which is somewhat confusing. President Obama signed a law that the Republican House and Senate insisted on. And what it did was it said that if a person had dual nationality, they were a European citizen who was normally entitled to travel without a visa to the United States, but they also had citizenship in one of those six countries, that they should not be allowed to travel to the United States visa-free, and instead they should be vetted through our normal extensive vetting process that happens at the consulates. So it really is apples and oranges, right? One is a policy that Republicans in the House and Senate pushed in order to increase the amount of vetting of people who had Europeans who had traveled to these six countries, and the other is a total ban on people from those countries in particular.
So back to Jeff, okay. Does that help?
No, because actually there's 2 points to this one. Okay, nobody forced Obama to sign it, first of all. So even though the Republicans were bringing up the bill, that's fair.
Yes, that's right. And President Obama must have agreed with it or been willing to sign it.
Well,
it's not apples to apples, Jeff, just to be clear.
Well, actually, but I don't know about that either, because the second part of his phrase on this one was that they had to be vetted out. What Trump is saying right now is that those countries can't be accurately vetted out. If that is the truth, that would actually hold in alignment with that.
The president is saying right now no amount of vetting is sufficient. These people need to be blocked. President Obama's order and the law that he signed said you must apply extra vetting. Bill, is that right?
Well, it said you must apply the normal vetting that people who aren't from Europe usually get, right? So, I think the president signed that as part of a very large budget bill that would have defunded the entire government if he would have vetoed it. So I'm not sure I would agree that evidences President Obama's support of the measure. The second thing is, as I said, as you point out, it is a measure which called for the normal vetting to be used from people who otherwise are vetted once. They now get vetted twice. So every European or Australian or Korean who comes to the United States for a visit is vetted by Customs and Border Protection at the airport. There's a second layer of vetting of having to get a visa, which now applies to people if you're from those countries, but you have visited or have the nationality of one of these countries where, look, the problem they were trying to solve is a very different problem from what the Muslim ban does. The problem they were trying to solve was European citizens who traveled to Syria or Iraq and fought with ISIS and then who wanted to come to the United States.
I see.
This travel ban is about not resettling refugees. It's basically this travel ban is saying that all of the people who work for the American government and trying to keep us safe aren't doing their jobs. So for the president to disrespect the national security employees of the United States, I think is shameful, really.
So Jeff, did you want to respond to that?
A couple things. Yes, I would love to.
Okay.
So there's a few different things that were in here. The first part is that we can't accurately vet some of these people. What he had asked for is actually a temporary moratorium for letting people come here from the entire country, not just Muslims. This is the whole other kind of thing that's kind of a fallacy, is that...
Although he did talk about a Muslim ban on the campaign. You know that, Jeff.
And actually, I'm not backing Trump on this, but I'm just saying just the facts as to how things work. Is that if you can't, and actually from what I've heard is that some of these countries don't have a proper vetting process in place, so they can't even truly identify if they really know a person, if the person is who they say they are. So in those cases, I guess... If you were in this position, how would you handle it if you couldn't actually truly accurately vet somebody?
Well, I think you hear our guests, and Kimberly, feel free to weigh in here. I think you hear our guests saying we have very good vetting procedures, and we can have confidence in the way the United States government vets them. Kimberly, what do you want to say?
Yes, yeah, certainly there are very strong vetting systems in place that have been strengthened over the course of the modern era of the war on terror. I also think the points that are being made are important, and I think this would be an entirely different case had the president never said, I'm calling for a ban on Muslims entering the country, because the president and the Congress both do have a very broad powers when it comes to immigration, certainly in the face of national security. And there are a lot of tools in the shed for them to use, including increasing vetting procedures and making it very difficult, and even if necessary, prohibiting for some period of time people from certain countries from entering the country. Those are all things that the president can do. The crux of the case here is the fact that the president said multiple times and put on his campaign website calling for a ban of Muslims from entering the country. And the courts so far, we'll see what the Supreme Court does in the fall, but so far the majority of the courts that looked at that saw a direct line from that intent right through the first and now the second travel ban that the president put in place.
I'm due to get a newscast in here, so we'll do that. And on the other side of news, Bill Stock and Kimberly Atkins continue with us, taking your calls and your questions, your concerns, your support for the travel ban, your questions about some of the questions that the Supreme Court may ask when the arguments happen in October. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. If you're getting a busy signal on the phone lines, you can reach me on Twitter. It's at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. To John Wanamaker now. Hi, John. What are you leading with?
Kerry, the U.S. military says it will investigate reports that a coalition airstrike may have killed over 40 prisoners held in an Islamic State-run jail in eastern Syria. Central Command confirmed to the AP on Tuesday that it struck IS facilities in the region. Syrian activists reported an IS jail was struck in the area on Monday and said at least 42 prisoners were killed along with several IS fighters. Senate Republican leaders are scrambling to rescue their health care bill. It is in deepening trouble as an insurrection grows within the Republican Party. The defections came as Congress's nonpartisan budget referee said the measure would leave 22 million more people uninsured by 2026 than the Affordable Health Care Act, which the Republicans are trying to replace. The European Union has slapped a record €2.42 billion fine, that's $2.7 billion, on internet giant Google on Tuesday for taking advantage of its dominance in online searches to direct customers to its own online shopping business. European regulators gave the company 90 days to stop or face fines of up to 5% of the average daily worldwide revenue of parent company Alphabet. Google is considering an appeal. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up at 11, the future of transit in the Twin Cities. What should and shouldn't we do? We will discuss that and invite your calls. We'll also remember soul singer Sonny Knight. There's a memorial for him this afternoon. Hear his final interview with NPR News at 11.
Hey, hanging out over the long 4th of July weekend, want something to feed your brain? Podcast, ready whenever you are. Right now on the podcast, Why More Women Don't Run for Elective Office, what Attorney General Sessions is doing with criminal justice reform, what aliens will want when they finally land on Earth. All there on the podcast, NPR News with Kerry Miller, wherever you get your podcasts.
Programming supported by the Shakopee Mattawakutan Sioux community, home of one of the Midwest's largest green roofs, a biomass heat and power plant, an organics recycling facility, and other earth-friendly programs to protect our lands and waters for the next seven generations.
Support comes from The Sheridan Room in Northeast on 13th Avenue, offering scratch comfort food, hand-squeezed juices to order, and cocktails on tap. You can bring your own records and add them to the all-vinyl playlist. More at thesheridanroom.com.
Little news here for you and a look ahead to our show tomorrow morning at 9. House leaders, including House Speaker Paul Ryan, held a press conference this morning about the Senate's health care plan. You'll hear more about that throughout the day. And then tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, we're going to talk about the details, the politics and the policy. Maybe I should flip that. The policy of the Senate plan and the politics around it. So that's tomorrow morning at 9. And again, taking your questions on it because the details are changing and the news is moving fast. And I want to make sure that you're as clear on this as you can possibly be. So healthcare tomorrow at 9. Back to the discussion this hour. Bill Stock with us, past president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and Kimberly Atkins with us from the Boston Herald, where she writes a lot about the Supreme Court and Congress. Bill, Kimberly, Bill, to you first on this. Are we missing anything in this discussion that you want to make sure that we have some clarity on?
Yeah, you know, the last caller actually put me in mind of the fact that, you know, the underlying rationale that somehow these countries don't give us enough information is really a red herring. You know, we don't rely on other countries to give us the intelligence that we need. You know, our vetting systems are based on information sharing, you know, we from our own sources, information that we share with the British and the Israelis and with hundreds of other countries around the world, and with the information that our own National Security Agency is able to gather about what's going on in other countries. So, you know, the fact that there are these vetting systems, we don't rely on other countries for the efficiency of our vetting systems, and this is again what sort of just I think is fundamentally disrespectful of all the tens of thousands of professionals who spend every day trying to make sure that these vetting decisions are made properly. To have the president come and say that, you know, their activities are worthless and he knows better than them, I think is just it's unbelievable for an American president to do that.
Kimberly, from your perspective, are we missing anything that we should be talking about on this?
Well, I think one point that when it comes to the Supreme Court case and what they'll be looking at specifically, and it was sort of alluded to in our discussion, but just to put a finer point on it, is these six countries that are being targeted by this terror, by this entry ban. When it's time for the government to explain why this policy is so necessary, it could cut against them because even if if the ban against entry from these six countries had been in place, it would not have stopped any of the recent terror attacks carried out in the United States, not San Bernardino, not the Boston Marathon attack, none of them. And so for the government to make the case that, hey, look, these are the places we need to look at, when in fact there are people who were either born in the United States or coming from countries like Pakistan or Saudi Arabia who carried out these attacks, is going to make it a lot tougher for the government to make that argument.
And I will add that that is also the case in London. Ivan says on Twitter, most recent attacks are perpetrated by people who were born in the country that they attacked in. To Ahmed in Bloomington, Minnesota. Hey, Ahmed, good morning.
Good morning, Carrie, and good morning to you guys. It's a very good conversation.
Thank
you. So I think what I wanted to say is, first of all, I have a direct experience on this because I went through this refugee resettlement process over 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And even as a little kid, I could tell you that it's extremely scary and it's been always extremely vetted. And I don't really know how much more you can add to it. And to Bill's point earlier, the U.S. has never relied on other governments for their vetting process. Those are professional people who knows what they're doing. Another point that I wanted to mention is many of the refugees from Somalia, for example, where I am from originally, have lived sometimes in like two generations at a refugee camps in Kenya or Ethiopia or other places. So it would be impossible that they would have information back in Somalia, even if there was more effective government or anything like that. So I think what it comes down to is there's very little U.S. national security interest in this. I think it's primarily the president, basically trying to come through on a lot of the red meats and rhetoric that he threw during the campaign, which largely support his base, which wanted a complete and a total ban on all Muslims. And some of them are saying that this is not even go far enough because only for six countries. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Ahmed, you bring up a good point. Kimberly, we haven't talked about the politics of this. As you take the temperature on Capitol Hill around this travel ban, what do you hear?
Yeah, well, obviously there is a strong support for having a robust counterterrorism and national security program here in the United States. I think you find that's one of the few places, I think, where there is bipartisan support. I think the division sort of falls on this, the belief of whether or not this is truly targeting Muslims or if this is just on its face a neutral policy aimed at giving the government the tools to better combat terrorism. That's something that it divides along political lines the same way that it could be dividing on the legal lines in this case.
But I'm remembering what Bill said a few minutes ago, which is Congress is the entity that makes the laws around this. So if Congress wanted to change the law on this, they could, couldn't they? Or did I misunderstand that?
Congress absolutely could. I mean, Congress is the body who is tasked primarily with immigration policy. But over the course of the time I've been in D.C. 10 years, and even before that, the debate over comprehensive immigration reform
right.
has never really made it out of the gate here. It's so politically fraught that Congress has really been at a deadlock in trying to impose any sort of policy, even if it's in the name of national security.
And Bill, absolutely. On overall immigration policy. But if Congress wanted to do specifically something with the way President Trump talked about this during the campaign, they could do that, couldn't they?
Certainly true, although certainly the incentives of the Republican-controlled House are, you know, not to go against the president or the base of voters who elected the president. So, you know, I think that is a way in which Congress in both parties, you know, we saw it with the Democrats in the House and Senate when they controlled it under President Obama. We're in this weird place where we don't expect Congress to stand up for itself, even when it's got control. When it has control by the same party as the president. And I think that's part of why voters are so happy to make sure there's divided government as much as possible so that people have to come to an agreement in order for new policies to be in place.
A call here from Berta in Preston, Minnesota. Berta, thanks so much. I know it's been a while. Appreciate you holding.
Right. Thanks for taking my call. I have a background in working with both refugees and also with international students. And I'm interested in knowing how Minnesota colleges and universities are being affected, especially as fall semester approaches. And I think what many people don't realize is that international students actually pay a high level of tuition.
Right.
So there's both a financial and student diversity question. Thank you.
Bill, do you know how this has affected universities?
Yeah, the final yield numbers are not yet available in terms of the number of applications, the number of accepted people who've decided not to come. So I think that is a number, though, that I think is really critically important to keep an eye on. These are students who are deciding to invest 2 or 4 years of their time in a graduate level or undergraduate kind of program. And yeah, I mean, clearly they have a billion-dollar impact on the economy of Minnesota. Just like with other states. So, you know, fundamentally, I worry that the overarching message that is being sent by this administration is that America is no longer open to people from other countries. And that's going to have a negative impact far beyond the Muslim ban. You know, the concept that people shouldn't come to the United States for schooling, that people shouldn't come to the United States for their health care, you know, that's going to damage. That's millions of jobs around the United States that are dependent on those kinds of tourism, education, medical care kinds of spending.
Ali says on Twitter, the governments don't vet refugees, as has been acknowledged here. The UNHCR vets refugees in the refugees camps. It's a 3-tier process, the UN, the host country, and DHS. And then he says, for instance, I was vetted by the UN in Kenya. The Kenyan government fingerprinted and documented it. And lastly, the DHS had a 3 vetting process. Want to get a call in here from Zena in St. Paul. Zena, I'm just a little tight on time, but wanted to hear from you.
Yeah, yes, just quickly. Thank you for taking my
sure.
call. My question is, I can't understand the choice of countries. September 11, most of the hijackers were from Egypt and Saudi Arabia, and mm-hmm. yet those two countries are not on the list. That's A. And B, I've never heard of an attack by an Iranian terrorist, and my understanding of the Iranian religious belief is that suicide
yes.
bombing is against their beliefs. And thank you.
And Iran is on the list, which is what I thought Zena was going to say. Kimberly, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, that's the point that I was making earlier. That's going to be a tough argument for the government to make to really prove this nexus between the order itself and its stated purpose of urgently preventing a terror threat. It's going to be a lot harder given that the countries, 9/11 included, were not the origin of any of the perpetrators of terror attacks since 9/11 in the United States.
And Bill, quick question to you. Do you believe, given these questions about whether this will be moot by the time we get to October, that the court won't have to take this up?
The court, there's an old saying in the law that the justices don't just read the briefs, they also read the newspaper. And it is possible that that by the time this is heard in October, and then, of course, a decision wouldn't be expected until perhaps as late as December or January, that 5 of the justices will either hold that it's moot or hold that sort of a very narrow kind of holding about allowing the second travel ban to stand, but sort of telegraphing that something as broad as the first travel ban would not get that kind of a favorable reception.
Got it. Kimberly, Bill, this has been so informative, so insightful. I really am grateful for the hour. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Kimberly Atkins from the Boston Herald, Bill Stock, immigration attorney and a past president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Now, my guess is you didn't listen for the whole hour. You probably had other things to do. If you caught a little bit of it and you want to hear the whole conversation, you can find it on my podcast, NPR News with Carrie Miller, wherever you get your podcasts.